Okay, hey folks. Well, I have the esteemed pleasure of talking with my good old buddy Rob Hayworth. He and I used to do some work back, or at least I should say he and my alter ego used to do some work back in the day of Regeneration TV. But these days he's fled California, he's out in the wilds of New Mexico, and he's stirring up trouble out in the universities. And it's a pleasure to have you here with us.
Thanks so much. Pleasure to be hanging out with you, too.
Definitely. Yeah, definitely. So the reason why I have you here, and I guess I'll tell everybody, the reason why I have Rob here is because he and I have been talking a little bit lately, and he's been talking to me about this connection between anarchism and education. And so I thought that was very interesting. I thought I'd share it with you all, and I thought you'd have a good time listening to it. But what I wanted to get into before that is I just wanted to know a little bit, give people a little bit of background about, you know, where you come from and, you know, and how it is that you became to encounter, think about anarchism or anti-authoritarianism or whatever label you want to stick on that.
Well, you know, I grew up in the Orange County and Los Angeles punk rock scene, you know, and actually I was kind of a late bloomer since I was younger, right, but all the older folks. But I got into punk rock when I was in the fifth grade, sixth grade. Started listening to Crass and actually most of the English punk bands at that time, and I think that was really important for me to kind of take those steps in the political direction. But you know, I really was, you know, interested in the music mostly, and I wasn't really paying much attention to the lyrical content. But that sort of notion of even dress at that time was sort of anti-establishment, and specifically, I mean, if you read some stuff by Dick Hebdige, kind of the subculture meaning and style, you can begin to start seeing some connections and why I'm interested, you know, why, you know, dressing or ripping your jeans or doing those sort of things were sort of an anti or resistance towards middle class values. And I think that was really important because I didn't really know it at that time. Of course, like, you know, I was in fifth grade, you know, I started wearing, you know, hair in a mohawk or spiked hair and then wearing, you know, Crass pins and then like a Bad Religion sign on the back of my, you know, army jacket. And of course I get sent home. you know, by the principal or whatever, saying, I'm distracting students because of your hair or whatever, you know. So, you know, they end up going, well, what's going on? Why can't I be who I want to be? You know, it's like, I mean, I feel comfortable wearing this and I feel, you know, okay doing this. But, you know, other people, I guess, because of the sort of dominant culture, specifically during the 80s, saying, oh, my God, we can't have that. Reagan would dislike that, you know, and so... even though he was wearing makeup at the time too, as well. So I was thinking about those things, but of course didn't have the context to, or contextualization to really understand like what were the, why I was doing what I was doing and what I was, you know, kind of envisioning or, you know, or what other punk rock, you know, people into punk rock were envisioning at that time. So.
But so you have, it sounds like then, though, that exposure to, it seems fitting that you would move on to work and try to draw connections between these two areas because they seem to have like an organic fit, like the issues that you were exploring in punk rock and those ideas were kind of rubbing right up against the institutions that you were dealing with in school.
Right. I mean, to be honest, it's, you know, we have, and I think this is important to note, is we have an informal and a formal education that we deal with, and those are always very complex in terms of the situations that we're in, of course, like culturally, politically, economically, whatever. You know, me coming from more of a sort of middle class background, you know, you began to start seeing these sort of, you know, notions of like, okay, I'm resisting this culture, but why are people questioning what I'm doing, you know? And so I began to start saying, well, you know, my informal education was we shouldn't trust authority. In fact, police officers were, of course, seen as, you know, not very nice or not adhering to what we were interested in doing, like putting on shows or going to concerts or, you know, putting on all-ages shows, whatever.
They take the rats away from all the kids.
Yeah, they don't, you know, kids, you know, they didn't want to, you know, do that at all. So, I mean, you know, or they didn't want to, you know, help us out at all. So, we began to, you know, I began to start looking at some of the notions of, you know, how am I learning, you know, now that I reflect on her, how am I learning, how did I learn informally?
Uh-huh.
And I did so through, and, you know, for instance, my own studies in terms of social studies, I started looking at, you know, how am I understanding the word? Why are we talking, why is the Dead Kennedys talking about a holiday in Cambodia? Or why are certain people talking about El Salvador during the 80s, of course, for Reagan period, or Nicaragua, you know, or the Sandinistas? Why, you know, why am I listening to this music that does that? And what does it mean? You know, and so I began to start, you know, questioning, like, wow, I'm not learning about this in my social studies classroom, right? But I'm learning about it through punk rock lyrics, right?
Uh-huh.
So I began to start thinking about my own understanding about how informally we educate ourselves through, you know, for me it was through a subculture. And we also, other people learn informally. But my formal education was saying, wait a minute, Christopher Columbus sailed the seven seas, you know, and I like to bring that up right now because he's, you know, of course we, you know, we're trying to continue to commemorate his slaughter of indigenous people in this conflict.
Yes, and this interview will actually broadcast on the fine day that he set out to do that.
Oh, God. So, I mean, you begin to start, you know, questioning these sort of, I guess, dominant cultural norms, right,
uh-huh.
that we continue to live under. And I think that, for me at least, those were the beginning question marks for, like, going, well, wait a minute, why are people telling me I can't believe this? Why are people telling me I can't do this? Like, you know, for instance, I was listening to the Social Distortion single 1945, you know, flying over Hiroshima 1945,
mm-hmm,
you know, and
mm-hmm.
starting to thinking about bombs and what that meant for people in, you know, Japan at that time. And so, you know, you begin, and what I'm learning in school is completely different than what I'm learning in the lyrics, right?
Mm-hmm.
Or whether I'm listening about religion, you know, about fascism, right? You know, about, you know, these certain, you know, when How Can Hell Get Any Worse came out, you know, that was something that was really important to me as well. So I began, and then, of course, I'm wearing a Crass pin, you know, and when we get the Big A, Little A bouncing, you know, and also Christ the album.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I have a big, you know, picture on my wall from G. Voucher, you know, with Reagan with the big muscles, you know, the Arnold Schwarzenegger muscles, and him shitting hot dogs and Margaret Thatcher, you know, eating them up. You know, it's kind of an interesting notion, and my mom's going, well, what, you know, in sixth grade, you're going, what the hell's going on here? So, but that was it, you know what I mean? That
uh-huh.
was my... my beginnings, you know, those are my beginnings of my informal education, I think, and concerning political issues around the world, and also resistance to those sort of notions or middle-class
mm-hmm.
value systems.
So I want you to tell a little story here. Like, this may be a little bit of an artificial way of inserting this, but I want you to tell a story about where those two worlds came really clashing together. And that's the incident with I don't even know, I don't remember what you said you used, if it was like a pin back or if it was a safety pin, but there was something involving a school official, your ear, and some sharp object. And what was that?
Yeah, I mean, basically, you know, it was sixth grade, and I remember you know, the principal, I remember I put, you know, I was putting my hair up in, you know, using a Knox gelatin, right,
uh-huh.
and spiking my hair, and I had a Dead Kennedy shirt, or no, actually I might have had a Dead Kennedy's Nazi punks fuck off shirt, and he basically said, you gotta go home, and I said, why do I have to go home? He says, you're causing a ruckus at the school, you're doing this, and I said, no. So I finally just, like, went up to him, and I said, I don't believe that that's right. I should be able to wear what I want to. I should be able to, you know, we have freedom of speech. And, of course, that time I didn't even know it. I barely knew what the Constitution, because none of the teachers knew anyways. And so I went up to him and I go, well, you know, fuck you, Moreland. That was the name of the principal at the time. And I put a safety pin through my ear, closed it up, and walked home. So, and, of course, I went to my mother that I went to my mom that night. I said, Mom, the principal's going to call tonight, you know, concerning an issue. So I got in trouble for that. So that was again another beginning of my anti-authoritarian sort of process. But you know, my brother was doing similar things. So I mean, I was enjoying watching him being sort of, you know, anti-authoritative.
Being a bad example for his younger brother.
It ended up being great, you know. So that was my story
Yeah, I joined the debate squad. My brother joined the football team. You and your brother started a band. Who's teaching who? All right. Hey, all right. So I want to switch gears just a little bit right now and actually get kind of into the meat of some of the talk that kind of replaying some of the things that we talked about a couple of days ago. And one of those things that we talked about was things that are happening with the content of education, the things that are, you know, not so much, yeah, you know, the things that are being said in the classroom, what kids are being taught, and what they have available to them when they go to their typical public school classroom. So one of the things that you had talked about, and I think hoping you can speak to that, is this movement. And actually, you know, I remember this happening back in, I even remember this happening back in, under the Reagan era of going back to basics. And there was a big move to try to really get people to learn the three R's, reading, writing, and arithmetic. But apparently now they've gotten a little bit more sophisticated about that. And they're, I guess the two words that you said that they're focusing on now are literacy and numeracy.
Right, right. And again, I think you've made a good connection as the beginning. And we can look further back, I mean, after Sputnik and all those other things, you know, trying to compete with the Russians, like, oh, we can't let those commies, get over. You know, have some sort of notion of superiority over the United States, right? And especially during the Cold War. But what happened in 1983 was kind of interesting. You know, we saw that Reagan period coming into this idea. They wrote this piece called The Nation at Risk. And The Nation at Risk was saying that, you know, schools are going to hell in a handbasket, and that, you know, if we're going to change education, we need to really model it after some of our competitors, right? Mm-hmm. So we begin to start looking at Japanese. You know, that's when we're seeing a lot of, you know, Americans bashing, you know, Toyotas and Nissans, and at that time, Datsuns, right? I think that's the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
You know, saying, God, you know, those Japanese are really, making us look bad. And so we decided that we needed to go towards more what we call, and we use these terms today in terms of No Child Left Behind, is accountability, right, and standardization. So we started seeing a lot of that kind of move forward. It didn't really come into fruition until we see No Child Left Behind, but we did see some things, movement towards that in terms of standardized tests, sort of cultural knowledge, you know, or what Michael Apple terms the official knowledge that we need to understand in society, right? And that means sort of the dominant, you know, cultural norms that we're, you know, aware of, like middle class values, like, you know, be a good person, be a good Christian, be, you know, traditional. Oh, Columbus was a nice guy. He didn't actually slaughter. He was you know, maybe shoving a few emoticons, you know, some certain way, not too happy of emoticons certain ways, or, you know, something like that. You know, so people began to start looking at standardization and accountability. I think that language really, really marks kind of what the Bush era, Bush the second, came out with in terms of No Child Left Behind. So we can kind of see a sort of, you know, and we saw some more during, like, you know, during the Clinton years too, so let's not get Bubba off.
Yeah, right.
You know, he was also an advocate for standardization, especially with, like, America 2000 and Goals 2000, those sort of things, that we saw more and more standardization. Now, that was, again, a part of the sort of Reagan era and the dismantling of public education, really. And, you know, begin to standardize it, get more money into the testing companies and the textbook companies, and really consolidate power and money within those within those contexts. So the official knowledge being, you know, Columbus is a great guy and the war on terror is a great thing, you know. And so we begin to start seeing that kind of come into fruition, especially when I was teaching social studies in the 12th grade, that, you know, the sort of patriotic zealotry started coming out, you know, and this sort of a hyper-nationalism and it was coming out throughout the country, you know, flag-bearing, you know, you're either with us or against this sort of mentality. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, a lot of the standardization is again, brings us this idea of the back to the basics, you know, that we need to learn just how to read and write. Okay, now it's, okay, we're behind in mathematics, so we need to generate more mathematicians. Now, there's a reason why they're doing that. I mean, there's a reason in terms of the connections between public schools now and the marketplace, which I think Henri Giroux and others have really written about continuously for the last, you know, 20-odd years.
Right on.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, totally, okay. Totally. So I'm curious then how you see the recent, I guess there are two things that I see that are happening, and they seem like they're on different fronts, but my sense is that they're part of this whole same package, and those are intelligent design in English only. And I guess part of the reason why I sort of sense that there might be a connection is because I hear those words coming out of the same mouths. That kind of gives me one kind of clue that there's, if it's not a conspiracy, it's at least some sort of a concerted effort. But I'm curious, like, what your take is on the importance of, or the impact, or potential impact of these two movements in public schools in relation to this kind of, you know, back to basics nationalism covered in the social sciences or do they call them social sciences now in the education area in schools? You know, like civics lessons, I guess, the civics curriculum and then the basics curriculum.
Right. So, you know, first off, intelligent design has been really pushed in a lot, you know, ever since we started seeing Christian fundamentalism. And I think, you know, I'll first talk about, you know, sort of the intelligent design and how that kind of came about. But also I'll talk about further after, you know, some of the connections with the sort of racist legislation that has gone through and taken hold within specifically Arizona, California, and those states, and Texas as well. But anyways, intelligent design, we can see the sort of power dynamics that are playing out. You know, we saw during the Reagan period, the sort of Christian fundamentalism had its sort of move forward, right? I mean, we saw, you know, Reagan really tapping into that sort of voter voter connection with some of those people, especially with some of his Christian values. Uh-huh. But and we saw, you know, some of, you know, George Bush won not as much, I don't think. But, you know, when we start seeing when GW2 comes in, we begin to start seeing a sort of a Christian fundamentalism. And I think a sort of a new kind of category in what Henri Giroux calls like the sort of proto-fascism that is occurring right now. And I think specifically it comes into, we have a market fundamentalism right now where basically whatever can stick on Walmart sticks on there, and if it doesn't, then the public pays for it. So we see a sort of market fundamentalism, a Christian fundamentalism, and the government all working together and creating sort of policy. So Christian fundamentalism, now that they're in power, are creating this sort of sense that we are a Christian nation, and, you know, the belief systems are, you know, we need to instill Christian values. If you go on the Eagle Forum website, you can see that their understanding of, or their argument is basically, we need to teach more Western civ, meaning Western civilization, Christianity, those sort of things. And that they have, and if you go onto their website, it's very fascinating because they're advocating for you as a Christian member of the Eagle Forum, right? to go out and say, we demand our kids to have Western civilization, okay?
Mm-hmm.
And you're denying our kids this because of this multiculturalism, right? That has been, you know, pretty much we live in a diverse society, and we need to understand that multiculturalism is a huge part of our society, right? But what happens is we begin to start seeing people making policy. For instance, taking the national the group that accredits colleges now are taking out gay and lesbian or queer out of their work in terms of social justice.
Wow.
Even the word social justice is being taken out of the NCATE standards for accreditation for teacher
wow.
education. So you begin to start seeing that the language is being taken away, specifically through a Christian conservative right agenda. And so this intelligent design, of course, they utilize the language that, of course, a lot of more left liberal folks are using is, you know, oh, we need to have diverse understandings of how the world, you know, has come about. But the realization
no one's talking about the Hopi creation myths.
Yeah, exactly. You know, yeah, or anyway,
right.
Yeah, exactly. So, but, you know, because we're in power, or they're in power, they're able to basically push that sort of political agenda. I get students in my class that continue to talk about how, you know, basically the world was created in 7 days and that we shouldn't be, and that science proves it, you know. Their science, of course, I use the same term as
science
in
quotation
structure.
Science in,
yeah.
We call it in square in scare quotes.
It's like voodoo economics,
voodoo
science. I mean, whatever you're trying to do, I don't know what you're trying to do, but it's, you know, it's kind of like Reaganomics. You know, don't piss on me and tell me it's raining. You know, that's the sort of, you know, perspective you're giving with the trickle down, right? So you begin to see those sort of, you know, this starts sparking up, and you begin to start seeing a lot more of the conservative agenda moving forward. Now, the language I used before, you're denying my kid the right to learn Western civilization under the Eagle Forum,
mm-hmm,
right?
Mm-hmm.
It's also the same slogan that was utilized under UNCS in terms of the anti-bilingual education, right? If you watched during that time period, the idea that and this is why people voted for it. I mean, if you actually go and watch the the commercials, it's fascinating. You're denying the right for my kid to learn English. I mean, think about the language there. I mean, it's incredible because it's the same thing as like what they're using that they were using for. You're denying my kid the right to learn Western civilization. You know, like Aristotle was a nice, you know, citizen, right? Or, you know, Socrates wasn't hanging out with, you know, young boys at the time either. Him and Foley might have gotten together just fine.
Oh,
right?
Ouch. Yeah, that's... I think that might be mildly homophobic there, son.
Oh, no. No, I don't think so. It, you know, because... I'm talking about pedophilia
yeah,
here. We're
true,
not talking
true.
About... We're not talking about homophobia.
True.
We're talking... We're specifically talking about pedophilia. I mean, think about it. I mean, Thomas Jefferson... You know, yeah, he wrote probably, you know, one of the, you know, founding fathers' documents for democracy, you know, in terms of democracy or representative democracy. But he was also a pedophile.
Wow.
Right? Socrates was a person that talked about, you know, he had an interesting dialogical process. But the idea, he was a pedophile, right?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, the idea that, you know, hey, I don't
I guess what you're saying, if Foley shouldn't get off the hook, neither should these guys.
Right. Absolutely. So, I mean, you know, and I think, you know, if it, I don't believe that comment would be homophobic. I think it would specifically be a comment saying, like, we need to get out of our understanding or our historical amnesia and really come to grips with what we're dealing with, right? And part of that is, you know, the idea that, you know, oh, we got to whitewash this sort of Thomas Jefferson was a nice guy. Yeah, he might have been a nice guy. Maybe you could invite him over for dinner.
But don't talk to him about the children he sold into slavery.
Right. And so yeah, exactly. So, I mean, and that's the whole point. I mean, you know, when you start talking about these things, I mean, so, I mean, yeah, I mean, I think that maybe you know, you could argue that that's a homophobic, you know, language order, but I would say that we need to begin to, and I use the anarchist term of, we need to expose illegitimate power continuously throughout, you know, throughout our discourse. Because if we're not, then, you know, we're really just kind of, you know, oh, well, Socrates did a good job. He really worked at the dialogical process. I'm like, yeah. But we can't deny what else he did, okay? We can't
You know, I've got other bones to pick with Socrates. Even with that dialogical process itself, anyway, you know, he was kind of not down with the sophists, I guess you could say. Down with the sophists at all. And, you know, his idea of, like, you know, justice is everything in its right place, which is another way of saying, boy, you get to the back of that bus. You know.
Right. And I also, you know, I would critique his dialogical process in the sense that his understanding is basically that he has the knowledge. It comes down to he has the knowledge. He's just asking you questions in order to, again, lift you up to a certain level
right.
of understanding, mm-hmm. right? And that has inequities in itself. And I think Paulo Freire mm-hmm. was talking very much against some of that those understandings, because he was interested in developing horizontal mm-hmm. dialogical
discovering
rather than
truths instead of
right.
imparting the truth.
Right, exactly. So I hope people don't misjudge that I was using Socrates and those things to kind of dismantle historical process.
Sure, and I don't think that you're homophobic. I know you a long time. I know that you're not. And
mm-hmm.
And I'm not, wasn't really particularly calling you out per se. Just like trying to give an opportunity to like unpack that association that people might have that like, you know, especially because since Foley himself is trying to use that, well, gee, the reason why I did all this stuff is because I'm gay, you know, which is a lame cop-out, you know.
Right.
There are plenty of gay
exactly.
men who don't feel the need to send pornographic images to young kids.
To young kids. Right. Exactly.
So I want to steer us a little bit back in the direction of talking about education a little bit and get back to what we were talking about before. We were talking about problems with, you know, trying to protect Western civilization through advancing an agenda that emphasizes a sort of a flag-waving civics program back to basics, numeracy and literacy programs. An emphasis or the inclusion of intelligent design in the science curriculum, and an emphasis on English only, like an emphasis on a particular kind of culture. And what I'm wondering is, so what's the problem with all this? Why would that be a problem? What gets left out with this? You know, what are some of the consequences that happen when students come to a school and they attend classes and this is what they're taught?
Well, this basically what's happened is this, is we've gotten away from some of the bilingual research. I mean, if you really look, I mean, just, it doesn't even take that much. I mean, Chomsky says this all the time, but if you begin to break down just a bit underneath the surface, you can find out that bilingual education research, and people have done 5, 7 year, you know, 10, 15 year studies about bilingual
mm-hmm.
education. Well, people say that, you know, in terms of, and you know, politicians specifically talk about how bilingual education is not working. We just need to put them and just immerse them into English. Now, let's break down what that means really quickly. Is what that means is when we, like for you or I, you know, we go and we want to learn
mm-hmm.
another language. So, of course, we go to Mexico or we go to Spain or and we learn Spanish, right? We immerse ourselves mm-hmm. in that language. Now, I ask you this. Are we content literate in that language when we just immerse ourselves in conversation?
Like, could I do a math problem in Spanish? No.
Right. Could you read or write?
Barely.
Probably not
really.
Okay. Well, that's the point here. Okay, so when we start thinking about English only, and you know, and this is a lot of the comments, specifically from a Eurocentric standpoint, is, oh, my friends or my family came over from Sweden or England or Sweden, Poland, wherever, and they picked up English just like that. And so when I return the question and I say, now, did they know how to read and write? And did they know, were they content literate in their first or in the second language? The majority of people are saying no. They were able to talk with people in English. So the idea is in bilingual education is basically that you become content literate in your first language, okay? And what that enables you to do as a student is to be able to take that and transfer that over to your second language, meaning that now I know if I'm content like literate in my first language, say Spanish, I'm able to go, guess what? I know what a verb is. Mm-hmm. I know what an adjective is. I know those sort of things. So then when a teacher says adjective, I can start transferring that knowledge over to my second language. Okay, that's the research, okay? Now, the idea that we begin to conflict is when it becomes, you know, politicized in terms of the political arena between Tweedledee and Tweedledum, right?
Translated and, for our audience, that's the Republican and Democratic parties.
Yeah, exactly. And so we begin to start seeing, you know, these folks saying, no, they just need to, you know, sink, the term we use in education is sink or swim, right? And that becomes very problematic because what happens is you begin to alienate students, and also students are not becoming, let's say you're a first grader, and you're not becoming content literate in your heritage language, you're unable to make any connection with the new sort of material. I shouldn't say all, but I mean most of the material in your classroom. So when a teacher says, where's the verb in this sentence? What the hell is a verb, right? And so the idea that bilingual education, English only, basically is a racist, you know, not only racist, but it's also dismantling any sort of the sort of real research that's going on out there in terms of bilingual education. And I think for the most part why bilingual education is not working is because it's not funded. And they're not and people aren't willing to take the 5 to 7 years that it takes for someone to become content literate in their first language and be able to transfer that over. So it really became politicized and polarized. Now there's another point of what English only is about too, and we're seeing this more on an international scale, is the idea that, and this comes out of Donaldo Macedo's work called The Hegemony of English. And I think for what happens in that is basically you're looking at sort of English as the business language of the world, right? That's why you see so many advertisements, I'm sure, in LA Times and other things to go to Korea and talk to and be an English teacher over there, right? Because that builds your influence in terms of creating business with, you know, people that know how to speak English. Now, that is the sort of hegemony of English. So the idea of English is not just we should be speaking it in California, right?
Right.
Or around the nation, you know, as the federal government is doing, but it's on an international level that is beginning to really, really put a hold in, like, China, putting it into Korea. Like, you know, I've talked to some of my colleagues from China, and they really do talk about how the emphasis is based upon English. You need to learn English. You need to learn English. And so your heritage language begins to go out the door because you need to learn the language of business, especially within the context of globalization, right? And that begins to have some cultural connotations and also some, I would say, even imperialist connotations, not only in the context of politics and economics, but in the sense of just culturally.
Yeah, I've got interesting story that kind of illustrates that. It's kind of working from this side, or the kind of expectation that people started to develop. I was recently called into jury duty, but because I've had some negative experiences with police officers, the prosecuting attorney decided that I probably wouldn't be the best person to listen to police officers giving testimony. But as part of that trial, as part of that procedure, there were a number of people who were called for jury duty who didn't speak English very well, who'd been living in the U.S. for a number of years. And one person in particular that judge spoke with was a man who came from Hong Kong. And the judge said, but, you know, I just took a trip to Hong Kong, and people seem to be speaking English there very well. So I don't really believe that you can't speak English well. And it just really struck me, like, this woman has a very, very narrow view of the world. I mean, not only that, but it's a very narrow vision of her experience in Hong Kong. Like, is she going and hanging out in, like, the back alleys? You know, is she going into the into the suburbs? Is she going into the areas where, you know, the tourists aren't hanging out? Or is she just dealing with people who deal with tourists on every day, who deal with, in other words, who deal in the commerce of working with the English, an English-speaking crowd, you know, with English-speaking clients?
Right.
And the assumption that people the people who do that, you know, that becomes the norm and the expectation, you know, is something that's not just, you know, it's something that's starting to seep through even among the political class here in the U.S. that, you know, of course everybody speaks English. What do you mean you don't speak English? You must be faking. You must be trying to get out of something. You're trying to get out of doing your responsibility and your duty as an American.
Right. And I think that's a great understanding of the larger picture, and also the privilege of what people have in terms of being monolingual, of being sort of out and about, like as in terms of like we go to these places, but we're not, you know, because I'm listening to the elite in Hong Kong or the elite in Korea, and because they're able to afford private tutors, right? And because again, it's a part of the business class that begins to begins to learn that sort of those elements. The other thing too is important to connect to is the idea of, you know, the idea of whiteness in general is beginning to start saying, okay, for myself, I'm able to when people look at me and say, oh, you're learning Spanish and you're becoming bilingual. Isn't that wonderful? Isn't that great? And that's looked at sort of an asset. So, but if it goes the other way around, as someone coming here, we expect, you know, immediately that they need to be learn English. You know, I can't understand you because you have an accent. Of course, you see in Los Angeles when I was living there, get rid of your accent for $10.95 an hour, or, you know, whatever it is they have, you know, there. And, you know, you begin to start saying, well, it's a, you know, people put pressure on quote-unquote, the other, right? Mostly Chicanos or, you know, Latinos or, you know, people that aren't, you know, or new people that have just come immigrated to the United States begin to say, okay, you need to learn English in order to, you know, you know, be in society. But for me, it's looked at as an asset, right? You know, oh, it's
well,
so
and
great
it's also
that
like,
you're
it. But the it's like when my experience when people talk about, I mean, except for when I'm around people who already speak Spanish and people who, like, the Latinos I speak to, they're not that impressed at all. In fact, my Spanish is, like, so bad. It's, like, laughable. But, you know, gringos, man, they're like, oh, you're learning Spanish. That's very impressive. You know, that must be so difficult. Yeah. And you think about it. I mean, Spanish is really a pretty easy language to learn. I mean, it's very nuanced, and to get a cultural understanding of it, to be, like, culturally literate, is something different than than understanding the language in a sort of global sense, right? But on a global sense, I mean, it's pretty consistent in its applications of the rules, you know. There aren't a lot of exceptions to the rules. There are some, but, like, except for, but in English, there's, like, there are multiple exceptions to every rule, and there are exceptions to the exceptions. You know, it's like there's no, it has such a long and funky history of development, that it's such a difficult language to pick up. And that's, I think, something that is lost on a lot of people. They just assume, like, well, you know, English is the language of common sense, but it's fucking not, Sorry, I'm like speaking here in the middle of the morning. I should probably tone down the language just a little bit. It's so complicated. You know, it's such a complicated, difficult, illogical, incoherent language that it kind of rubs up against this notion, this sort of common sense notion that, well, yeah, you should just learn English. It's not that hard. I did it when I was a kid.
Right, and I think another thing you bring up is really important in terms of the pedagogical, meaning the sort of teaching and learning process of literacy, especially within English, is very problematic. The Back to the Basic movements looks at sort of phonics as being the sort of end-all, right? I mean, they're looking at sort of doing phonetic awareness is great. Well, you know, if you really look at it, you're just grunting, right? You're learning to grunt. You're really not making relationships about reading or writing with the larger
context. Hey, it puts W on the
world.
Even playing with the rest of us.
Right. So I would even say, you know, pedagogically, how we teach English or literacy in general is based upon this sort of phonetic awareness, where people aren't, you know, like looking at a certain word, they're not looking at it in terms of the world that they're looking at, but they're looking at it just like this phonetic awareness, and it just makes no sense, really, you know what I mean, to their understanding of the world. Now, I would, again, with sort of this sort of Freirean notion and other folks that have done that before, is like, hey, you just do it in the context of the world, right? You do it in how you name the world, how you understand the world. So I think it's really important that not only English is forced down people's necks, right, in terms of, or down their throat, but they're also being taught in a way that is also unintelligible in terms of how we understand language, really, and how we understand how to read or write or say things, right? I mean, I don't sit there and go, right, Stephen? You know what that means, right? Right? I mean,
sounds like a Saturday Night Live skit.
In the chair, right? It's like, right, exactly. So I'm not grunting. I look at a cat and I point to it and I go, that's cat. You know what I mean? And so it's not, this sort of phonetic awareness becomes so dominant within our teaching of literacy. It just really becomes problematic, not only just English only, but in terms of how we teach language in general is just problematic.
So I want to skip ahead a little bit because we are marching ahead. The clock marches ahead as we get in deeper. But because there's one other area that I really wanted to get into with you, and that is the structure of the classroom and the structure of education and what that means for education. Because, I mean, I know that, like, probably everybody listening here probably has the same or very similar experience of, sitting in classrooms in neat rows of desks with a teacher up at the front and, giving the lecture and, people raising their hands and stuff like that, and then tests being handed out and people having to fill out the tests, and then they get told, well, you're an A student and you're a B student and you're a C student and you, unfortunately, are going to end up in special education and, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so I'm kind of curious what your thoughts are about, what's up with that? What kind of impact does that have, and what does an anarchist have to say about that kind of educating?
Right. And I think for the first part, we can look at the idea of schooling. In the 1830s, we can look at some of Michael Capp's work in talking about pre-industrial capitalism, and really look at the notions of how public schools were developed, right? You can look into Horace Mann and all those folks, but I mean, specifically, it was the idea of control. I mean, we were, during the 1832, we started looking at schools as being a function of controlling young people, because we were seeing immigration at that time. People, specifically Irish folks, were coming over. And we had somewhat of a class system, developing in terms of the middle class. And the middle class, of course, were getting all uppity. about, oh my gosh, those Irish folks, we better put them in, we need to control them. And so what better way to do it than to, we didn't want to put them in jail because that would cost too much, but, that's not the case now, but in terms of, we need to control them, so we make public schools to what we call the assimilation process, right? We did that with indigenous population, is control them. Schools began to control people and assimilate them into a certain power structure. Now, Bowles and Gintis came out, in 1976 talking about the issues of, schools mimicking the sort of, or reproducing the class structure that we live under. Specifically, bells, right? When we have bells that go off, it's just like the workplace, right? We begin to start looking at how bells go off, so we know what's, break time for, coffee. Well, for, kids, it's some sort of snack time if they have enough money to be able to have that nowadays. But, then it goes into lunchtime. Okay, the bell rings, we do that. Now, knowledge also is utilized through that. And I think specifically we can look at that through the idea of Taylorism. Taylorism basically came about. It's the sort of scientific method that was used in the workplace, correct? I mean, it was like, you use a stopwatch and you basically see how many shovels of coal you put into the furnace after an hour, right? And if you're not being efficient enough, well, maybe we need to move the coal pile closer to the furnace or whatever. Now, that kind of filtered into the school system, specifically through time tests, right? I mean, I'm sure you remember going, okay, 2 times 2, 4 times, okay, you have 5 minutes to take this test, right? And then after that, if you do well, we'll give you an A, B, C, or maybe
I didn't do well on a timed table test and got put in remedial math. And then at another school got took a standardized test and tested in the 98th percentile in math.
Wow. So you can see how standardization is very subjective in terms of its how we even understand knowledge. In fact, I don't even think it's a clue of what type of knowledge we are understanding in the world. But so we can look historically, and I don't want to go through everything. But specifically, we looked at how basically public schools can mimic sort of the workplace, and we can see that structurally too, right? We have the factory work floor being, specific as the classroom being set up in rows, right? Or military operations or whatnot, right? Walk down the hall, you better stay in line, or you're going to, the teacher's going to get upset, right? So those sort of structures, public schools have really, been based upon control. And if you notice too, we were very much adherence to, the Skinner, the B.F. Skinner, and the sort of ideology of behaviorism, right? If you do certain things, stimuli, if you do good, you get a cookie, if not, you get a cattle prod or something, like those sort of things in class. Like, oh, you've been acting up, we better throw you in the corner, right? So the idea of control, right? But we now have come about and saying, really what's happening is we're spending more time trying to control the students through these behaviorist mechanisms. And then on top of that, besides really learning and engaging in learning in our public schools. So it really comes down to, we're spending more time as teachers being behaviorists, right? Which has actually been, a lot of people have gone, behaviorism is not a good thing for young people and students as well in terms of their understanding or how they learn. But I think it's really important to say that public schools have been developed as a control mechanism.
And that's bad somehow.
And that is bad.
I mean, my understanding is that these kids are all running crazy, and that the reason why there are all these problems is that there's not enough structure or discipline or control in schools, that people are just, teachers don't care anymore, and there's no structure to this, and, the anarchists are taking over, basically, and now these kids are just going crazy and shooting each other and shooting us, and what's the deal?
Well, what's interesting is, when I've always been asked, and this is a typical question for a superintendent or
a
principal or whoever's interviewing you in terms of getting a public school job, is what is your classroom management? And I always say none. And I've gotten every job that I've applied for. So my mine is none. I don't have any classroom management. And they look at me all weird and funny, like, you have no control, you know. The thing is, learning is a social process. In fact, learning, we've now discovered that we really need other people to, you know, have conversations or have dialogues or whatever to create meaning. Right. That's why we have, you know, what's interesting is we used to have in elementary school, if you, I don't know if you remember this, but there was more collaborative efforts, meaning you had four desks sitting together and you did group work and stuff like that. Well, that gets torn out of your system and socially constructed in a socially constructed way through high school, junior high or high school. You begin to have this sort of what we call, you know, sort of this what critical pedagogues call sort of a hyper-individualistic process, right? You know, where we're just like out for number one, right? This sort of competitiveness, this sort of idea that, you know, if the student sitting next to me is doing better than me, I better start stepping up the ball game and, you know, kick his ass academically, right? So you know, you begin to start saying, well, what, you know, why are we doing that, you know? And again, that perpetuates the sort of capitalist mentality or even the marketplace mentality that we have today, meaning that A, we need to have some sort of control over a workforce, and that's what Bowles and Gintis were talking about in 76 was this sort of reproductive cycle of the social class structure, right? Meaning that schools are reproducing. I remember, I mean, you know, hanging out with you,
out east
a little bit, you know.
I'm not ashamed. I used to live among the Utahs.
Out east a little bit, you know, 10 hours away. I
used to live on Planet Utah. I'm not from there. I just used to live there.
So
I used to live in a place associated with the planet Kolob. Yes.
So, you know, in doing some research there, and I ran into brick walls there, and this is my undergraduate there, I was asking the question, okay, What is it that I was asking questions? Okay, how many vocational ed are in the West Side, which was more working class neighborhoods, you know, and stuff like that, compared to how many vocational ed and AP classes were over on the East Side, which is more of the wealthy folks over there, right up on the hill. So when I started asking for how many students were enrolled, how many, you know, AP courses. You know, you began to start seeing, A, some resistance towards giving me that information, because then I could make an argument that students were not getting equal opportunity to, you know, education, to their education, meaning that some students that wanted more AP classes not having the opportunity to do such, right? This came clear to me going into Englewood now that we have, you know, we have this sort of Williams case that, you know, and continued on, which basically we're seeing a major backlash of, like, let's say in Englewood, we're seeing maybe, you know, a very minimal amount of AP courses, but 10 miles down the road at Beverly Hills High School, we're seeing, you know, a large amount of AP courses being offered. So we can see these sort of social class division and also the sort of reproduction of that. Now, that's, you know, to me, I think that, yeah, and I think that that's important to recognize. Now, as, you know, anarchists would say, well, fuck public education altogether. You know, I, you know, screw all this. There is an anarchist pedagogy. It's not a deterministic factor, but there are ways, and I think you made it very clear on, you know, in terms of your little Skype thing here, is organizing anarchists ain't no oxymoron, right? So organizing takes some sort of pedagogical practice, right? It takes, and I think what Paulo Freire talks about is a sort of action-reflection process. And I think Chris Kraft said a few things, and he's used a few of those sort of notions of using Freirean notions of how we need to really contextualize or theorize what we're actually doing. Because if not, we're just doing what Frey calls verbalizing, mm-hmm. which is blah, blah, blah to him. So I think that, you know, there are some efforts to, especially within anarchist circles, like, well, you know, saying like, you know what, actually there is a sort of anarchist study. And we can look at that. And I would turn people on to some works, you know, in terms of the Spanish anarchists, Ferrer and Francisco Ferrer, and some others who really kind of delved into, and also you know, now the Albany Free Schools and those sort of things of looking sort of notions of direct democratic or participatory spaces. Mm. And, you know, rather than going like, okay, you know, fuck everyone and fuck this stuff, you know, and sorry my language, but in terms of, you know, the morning show, but I think it's important that we understand that it's not about centralizing a certain sort of curriculum or centralizing a certain sort of pedagogical practice, but it's taking into account all these different spaces, meaning autonomous spaces, if you're talking about anarchists, and looking at those autonomous spaces and going, how do we want to understand power? How do we want to understand organizing? And taking those into account. Like, so every public school, I mean, we shouldn't look at this as No Child Left Behind, but we should look at it as a space, because there are spaces in public schools where students are making decisions. In fact, I've seen that go on, people using formal consensus and those sort of practices within some of our social studies classrooms at a high school here in this town. And I think I find that fascinating because, you know, is someone going to say, well, he's working at the state? Well, we have to get back to the IWW notions that, you know, we need to build a new sort of way of living out, you know, inside mm-hmm. the old. I mean, we have to do it in the here and now. We can't wait till, as Marx said, wait until economic conditions are ripe and ready to go, and then we'll start, you know, fucking up the program. You know, it's like, we're doing some stuff here in the now. And yeah, and we're trying to do these sort of things. And I think there's some folks like Fred Day and other folks that are talking about, you know, really working and creating spaces now that are anarchistic in manners. And I think David Graeber is also doing some great work in recognizing that we're doing anarchism mm-hmm. on a day-to-day basis, right? And that it should be acknowledged, yeah. right?
No, that sounds great. In fact, that pretty much covers what I wanted to cover. And I'm looking at the clock right now and seeing that, yeah, we need to kind of put a cap on this right now. So, but I do want to thank you for taking the time out to chat with us here on the Hacienda and breaking down some of the myths and misconceptions and misunderstandings maybe people have had about education and the educational system, and especially in like in turning people on and talking about what that there are actually alternatives out there.
Right, and I want to close by saying, hey, resistance is not futile, as the Borg would say, right?
Yeah, definitely. Hey,
thanks so much, Stephen. I really appreciate.
Stephen, I don't know who you're talking about. My name's Boy Howdy.
Oh, Boy Howdy.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're going to have to cut me off. You stop it?
Oh, yeah. Yes, I guess we're going to be stopping it here. Again, thank you to Rob Hayworth for sitting around and chatting with us here on the Hacienda, killradio.org.